listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, with Sarah Browning and Jill Carpenter. So we're back again with the History Out Loud podcast after our Christmas break. It's 2022, and sadly we don't have Sarah Rose with us for this episode, but I've managed to get another Sarah from Local Studies in Halifax and Todmorden Library. So welcome, Sarah Browning.
Hello.
Sarah isn't actually a stranger to History Out Loud. She's been one of our esteemed guests in the past for an episode called A Todmorden Murder, The Case of Clara Law. And that was a very popular episode.
I promise I will be far less gruesomely detailed in this episode. I don't think too many people die in this one, so that's good.
No. So today we're going to be talking about severe winters of Calderdale and beyond. Looking outside at the moment, it's not looking particularly severe. It's pretty mild, actually. I went out with the dogs earlier and the birds are singing, the crocuses are poking up through the soil. So I don't want to jinx it, but I don't think we're going to be breaking any records this year.
No. No, we've had our extreme weather for the last month or two already, so we can rest easy now, can't we?
Hopefully. Although I do like a bit of snow.
I do too, but when I have to go to work just so I can make a cup of coffee, I'm not so keen on it. It loses its charm at that point.
So I was thinking of any experiences that I could talk about of severe winters from my lifetime, but unfortunately they all seem to blend together into snowmen, snowball fights, sledging, not being able to go to school, that kind of thing. The most recent one I think that we've had that was pretty severe was what they called the Beast from the East in 2018. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
I've got a couple of stories from there. I've got a rat story, or I've got a potential frostbite story. Which one do you want to hear?
I know you in person and you're not missing any fingers or toes, at least not that I'm aware of. So let's go with the frostbite one because you did recover.
Okay, right. So it was during the Beast from the East and I was out up on Lumbank near Heppenstall taking photographs of really spectacular snow drifts that were making waves against the stone wall. And after a while, I started to notice this really intense pain in my fingertips. And suddenly in my head, I had this vision of Ranulph Fiennes sawing off his frostbitten fingertips during an expedition. Those gnarly little black fingertips. And so I didn't have any gloves on, so I quickly put them back on and put my camera away and went home. It was quite an intense pain. It did go away, but I was a little bit worried at the time. Maybe I'm just a bit of a wimp. Sarah's not, as you might have gathered, isn't from these shores. She's native of Delaware in the USA. So do you have any snow stories?
I do. And I was laughing thinking about the Beast from the East because I made myself very unpopular with my husband and other friends in 2018 because I was like, oh, this is nothing. You should see the winters we get. And my poor husband having to get home from Barrie and it taking about 7 hours was like, I don't want to hear about your terrible winters. This is bad enough for me. My cousin was reminding me of one, which I remember very distinctly, but I couldn't quite place what year it was, but it was 1996. And we had 22 inches of snow. And she was posting some photographs of it on Facebook. And I was thinking, yeah, I remember that because we actually got 3 whole days off of school, which because where we are in Delaware, we either get very mild winters or once every 7 years or so, we get just an absolute banger. And we have snow plows, we have gritters, everybody has snow chains for their tires, et cetera. So, you know, you might get a day off of school if it's especially bad, but to have 3 days off was the most amazing thing for a 13-year-old to ever have. And I remember making an igloo in the big drifts of snow that the plow had pushed up, which the drifts, the plow coming through would bring it up to a good a good, you know, 15, 20 feet high of snow along the sides of the roads. And my mom saying, you're going to cut the snow, collapse on, you'll die. And I was like, yeah, but this is so cool. What a way to go. And she's like, no.
The fearlessness of youth.
Yes, exactly. When nothing could ever happen to you, that's bad. But the other winter that I have very fixed in my mind, it's not one that I lived through, but we have some family photographs in my my grandpop's grandmother's family Bible. And there's one of my grandpop standing on the Brandywine River, like right out in the middle of it, stood on the ice. And he would have been, it was 1933, so he would have been about 18 or 19. And he's doing that thing that young men do in photos back then, where he's trying to look all hard and like, yeah, I'm cool. And he's got like a waistcoat and a thin cardigan on, and, you know, a hat, you know, a flat cap. And he's trying to look cool, but he's got his arms sort of behind him a little bit. And you can just tell by the way he stood that he's really cold.
It's a really good photo. And I love the name of the river as well, Brandywine River.
When I first moved up here, every time I'd go past them through London Foot on the bus, the old Brandywine pub there, I think, ha, I know that. But yeah, I did a little bit of digging on newspapers.com about that winter. And it was the newspaper articles were sort of, it's the coldest ever, many deaths reported, etc. But there's also lots of little neat details, like people's false teeth freezing in the cup of water by the side of their bed. Ooh. And ice that's 4 inches thick on the inside of windows, and, you know, things exploding from the cold and things like that. So there are lots of little interesting anecdotes.
You imagine, like, you get up and there's a row of teeth and glasses on top of the fire or near the fire. No one can eat until their teeth have thawed out.
you can have some cough drops until your teeth thaw out. Yeah. But yeah, the lowest for Delaware during that storm was 0 Fahrenheit, but apparently it was all of the Northeast and the south of Canada on the Northeast coast that had this massive, terrible cold snap. And the paper was saying that in New York it was between 20 and 40 degrees below zero, which again, Fahrenheit. That's horrifying.
That just blows everything I'm going to say for the next half an hour out of the water, but never mind. So if we return to old Blighty, and so a little bit of background, how do we know about historical temperatures for this country? And so there's something called the Central England Temperature Records, and they extend back to 1659. So we do have quite a backlog there to look at. The temperature readings weren't always very reliable in the Middle Ages. Quite often it would be gauged by the thickness and duration of the ice. That you know, that was how you would know how bad it was. And winter was defined as between December and February. Once you start looking at severe winters, it can get a bit confusing with numerous grueling spells just popping up, defined as the Great Frost of 18 or something or other. So you can get a little bit lost in all that. So for the sake of clarity, I'm going to keep it just to what I'm calling the Big Four. So that's the big freeze of 1962-63, the winter of 1946-1947, and the great winter of 1708-09, and the great frost of 1683-84. So if we start with the most recent and then work our way backwards, I think that's the way to go. The big freeze of 1962-63, so that's before me even, definitely before you. From Boxing Day 1962 until March 1963, most of Britain was under snow, with temperatures 5 to 7 degrees below average. So that's a pretty long time, really, to be looking out your window and just seeing white. It's hard to imagine. The longest I can think of snow being on the ground is probably about a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just about to say. you sort of associate that with sort of looking at the tops, and because it never melts off the tops and the shadows of walls and things like that, but an actual blanket of snow on the ground, on the valley bottom, if you think of that, it is quite rare that we have that.
Yeah. So it was dubbed the Big Freeze, and it kind of seeped into popular culture. It was referenced in a song by the Dream Academy. I don't know if you've heard of the Dream Academy, sort of 80s band in the UK. And they had a 1985 song called Life in a Northern Town, which was actually a dedication to Nick Drake, a singer-songwriter.
I know Nick Drake.
you know Nick Drake. But the lyric in one of the lines is, in winter 1963, it felt like the world would freeze with John F. Kennedy and the Beatles. I don't think I really remember that line in the song. I remember the chorus. Anyone who knows it knows the chorus. It's very. You need to go and put it on Spotify and you'll know what I mean. So what was going on, and what were the papers saying? So on January the 21st, after a weekend of the worst snowstorm since 1947, snow blocked virtually all Trans-Pennine routes. The M62 hadn't been built at this point, and the only road that was accessible was the A646 Burnley Road running along the bottom of the Calder Valley. The Halifax Courier at the time reported that every available Halifax Corporation workman was out in the monster operation to relieve road chaos. The convergence of commercial vehicles was so great that police were on special duty to keep traffic moving to and from Lancashire. So in those days, it was pretty bad. Obviously, nowadays, we don't get the police out.
No.
I don't know about you, but I find the idea of nose-to-tail traffic on the Burnley Road being a novelty quite hard to believe, really. And I'm sure most people who have to commute every day would agree. So yeah, but in those days, it, you know, that was a novelty. Amongst those stuck in the traffic were officials of the Ministry of Transport and West Riding County Council Highways Department. And one of the Ministry Travels subsequently compiled an urgent report. I can only imagine that he gets out his pen in the car, because by February 1963, only a few weeks later, a proposed route for the M62 has been unveiled. They got on with it pretty quickly after that.
If you experience it, it lights a fire under you.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the motorway, the M62, had been talked about since 1934. But yeah, as you say, I guess with a lot of projects that are quite difficult to get off the ground, it takes a bit of a disaster to get everyone moving. So my mum, she travelled by bus along this route. She doesn't live around here, but she lived in Manchester, and she said it was about 7 weeks where that was the only passable route, which is quite a long time, really.
It is.
So what else was happening? The Shea Stadium in Halifax, of course, sporting fixtures were cancelled, and the Shea Stadium set itself up as a public skating rink. I don't know how you do that. What do you do? Just flood the pitch?
Yeah, it can't have been like when they used to have the skating rinks at the Peace Hall, because it would be built up and put in. It wasn't just, you know, it's really slippery, bring your skates. So,
yeah.
Maybe it was just waterlogged and froze solid, and they just sent somebody over with a Zamboni to smooth it down.
Yeah. Hundreds of people came and enjoyed that. Of course, spring does come eventually. And on March the 6th, it was the first day of the year when there wasn't actually a frost. That must be, you know, you wake up one morning and suddenly after weeks of frost, it must feel amazing. You'd be out in your T-shirt, even though it was still cold. Temperatures after that quickly rose and the snow melted. So
yeah,
that was the end of that one. Going back to the winter of 1946 and 47, there isn't a special little name for this one. It's just the winter of 1946-47. And it was also particularly grueling. The country was still recovering from World War II at this time. So we weren't really off to a good start.
No.
And in the December of 1946, Britain was on the receiving end of freezing temperatures and snowstorms that left huge drifts. Now, this brought disruption to travel and also to energy supplies. So roads and railways were blocked for extremely long periods, and there was problems transporting coal to power stations. And quite a number had to be shut down, and this led to restrictions in power use. So with domestic energy, use was limited to 19 hours a day. I suppose that sounds quite a lot, but I suppose it depends which 19 hours they're saying, doesn't it?
Very true. Yes.
Some industrial supplies were cut completely, and radio broadcasts were limited. Television services were suspended. Some magazines were ordered to stop publishing, and newspapers were reduced in size. So when I first thought of newspapers being reduced in size, I thought, ooh, little dinky little mouse-sized newspapers or ones that fit into your bag. But actually, I'm thinking about it now. It probably just means less pages, doesn't it?
Yeah, no advertising, probably.
Yeah.
No, it's horrible to think of the no power because, and I suppose we experienced this, you know, in December, but to a maybe to a lesser extent. I honestly don't know, but there would have been a massive disparity in how that would affect people, because if you were somewhere where you had a coal burner or an open fire or some sort, I mean, restriction of the coal deliveries, et cetera, domestically would be a problem, but you would still have options to heat your house. But if you were in a flat or if you were somewhere in a city and you didn't have, you know, if everything that you ran in your house was based off of electricity, then you would really struggle. It would be a much different prospect for you than somebody in an old fashioned house or a cottage or something who might find that they, you know, if they had some wood stored up, they could at least heat their front room, if nothing else.
Mm. In 1947, the Minister of Fuel and Power, Emmanuel Shimwell, he actually received death threats and he had to be placed under police guard. That's phenomenal, really. That just shows how awful it was.
This weather was referenced in James Herriot's books, wasn't it? Because he writes about terrible winter in the Dales and, you know, livestock freezing underneath the snow and nobody to get anywhere or heat their homes or anything like that. So it exists in the literary imagination, popular imagination, as much as it does in actually people who live through it. You know, it's very, it can be very real to someone who's read about it now as much as then.
Because animals did perish, livestock died in the fields, vegetables were frozen into the ground. I mean, you don't actually think about that, but how would you get them out? Potatoes and carrots, and in some areas they use pneumatic drills to extract them, which sounds pretty labor intensive to me. You'd have to work pretty hard to get a handful of carrots, wouldn't you?
If you're desperate, I suppose you would.
Because of all this, rations were rationed. So they were still on rations from after the war. And then those rations were rationed. It's just grim, really. I mean, thinking about this area in particular, whole villages in the Coldsdale area were completely cut off. So you've got places like Blackshaw Head, Slack up on the tops, just having no transport access at all. On the 10th of February, supplies were dispatched to Blackshaw Head by horse-drawn sledge. And it was the village's first contact with the outside world in 11 days. So I guess you could sort of come out of your house and walk, but really there might be a limit to what you could carry, and also depending on how fit you were, how old you were. they had specially adapted diesel boats were used to break the ice and keep the cauldron Hebel navigation open. And this was to transport coal to Brighow, Selland and Sorby Bridge gasworks. On the 30th of January, the Halifax Evening Courier reported 18 degrees of frost were recorded at Halifax Bellevue Meteorological Station in the 24 hours ended at 10 a.m. today. The lowest reading since January the 6th, 1941, when there were 19 degrees. So degrees of frost is a non-standard unit of measure. So we'll probably end up talking quite a bit about degrees of frost. In England, it's the number of degrees Fahrenheit that the temperature falls below freezing point. So freezing point Fahrenheit is it 32 degrees?
Yeah, 32, yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose when we're talking about 18 or 19 degrees below that, that is pretty cold for this country.
Yeah, I can confirm it is very cold. I have experienced it.
Halifax was a little bit fortunate up to this point, and it goes on to say, the Courier, up to today, Halifax, through technical reasons, has not had to suffer electricity cuts during this week's severe weather, but grave warning of what the town may expect in the future was issued by Mr. A.G. Connell, manager of Halifax Electricity Department, this morning. So Halifax for a while was okay, but there was warnings and, you know, that this might not continue. There was a couple of other things in the newspapers at the time. One was a letter, which I thought was quite good, that was written to the Courier, and it was published on the 5th of February. And it's from someone who signs themselves simply as just Moorside, which is a bit...
That's a good start.
Yeah.
I'm about to say something terrible.
Yeah. It goes, "Sir, I sometimes wonder if the schools have really progressed. When I attended school at Bolton Brow, we had the choice of a mug of warm or cold milk every day. How we appreciated that warm drink in the winter. Now, 20 years later, with the temperatures below freezing point, the children are faced with a bottle of half-frozen milk or nothing at all." So I think I'd have quite liked a mug of warm milk occasionally.
I know. I was never offered such a thing. I'm very, very bitter about that.
Did you get milk in the US at school?
We did, but you got it at lunchtime. It was in a carton and it was cold. It wasn't something that was served up, but the school I went to, it didn't have a cafeteria. So you just brought your own lunch, and it was only something like milk or orange juice that would be supplied, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. We had little bottles with a pink straw. You just poked through the top. That was until Mrs. Thatcher got rid of it. We won't say any more about that. Moving swiftly along. On the 8th of February, there was another report in the paper and the title was "Two More Buses Stranded." Again, it's about transport problems. Much of the improvements in bus service reported yesterday has been set back by last night's renewal of the blizzard. Yesterday afternoon, a service started to Heptonstall Slack and continued until tea time, but then the blizzard caused the drift to cover the road again, and two more buses were stranded to join company with the two that have been isolated at Heptonstall for several days. So Heptonstall, you can imagine visually, it's turning into a bit of an abandoned ghostly bus depot up there. I guess they're trying, as we all always do, I suppose, to make a headway with things, and then we just keep getting knocked back.
But there's very recently been a really, really bad snowstorm in the US on the East Coast. And there's been, I think it was in Vermont, there were people died because they were like a whole highway. Everybody was snowed onto the highway and couldn't leave. And it took a good 2-3 days for rescue crews to get there and for the road to be cleared enough for people to drive out and for people to be, you know, gotten free from their cars and rescued. And
yeah, it's happened in Pakistan as well, hasn't it, very recently as well.
Yeah.
I think it's probably because of global warming, these things are just coming out of the blue very suddenly and very severely. And unfortunately, we're going to have to change our mindsets to fit around that. So back to 1947, again, once March came round, a thaw began. But because the ground was so frozen quite deep into the soil, the thaw was only melting the surface snow and it couldn't sink down into the soil. So it melted and ran off. And there was a lot of flooding in many areas because of this. So adding insult to injury.
Absolutely.
So in the 1950 general election, it's thought that the governing Labour Party lost many seats to the Conservatives due to their handling of the crisis. That's what happens, isn't it? You could be any party in power. I mean, obviously some will handle it better than others, but really when it comes down to it and a general election, your time's up if you've not, you know, if you've just not stepped up to the plate or you weren't able to.
Yeah, you're responsible for whatever happens while you're in government, yeah. Whether you're responsible for it or not, really.
So going back a bit further and into the 1800s, we get several mentions of particularly harsh winters in local newspapers. There's a quote from the Courier in December 1925 that addresses this quite well. And it goes, which was the greatest frost in our history is a question not easy to determine, for the old writers love the superlative and had always, so to speak, never seen anything like it in their lives. So, yeah, it's like, no, my frost's better than your frost type scenario.
it's literally clickbait.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the worst one ever. Buy our newspaper and find out why.
Yeah. In another article of the time, a snippet entitled The Weather, and this is from the Halifax Courier again, and this is dated the 24th of February, 1855, and it brings to attention the terrible weather that's happening at the time, but also highlights a previous great frost, in inverted commas, from 1813 to 1814. And this is what it says about that. We have hardly had so severe a frost as the memorable great frost of 1814. At that time, the thermometer fell as low as 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit. The Thames was frozen over and a Saturnalia was held on the ice. So Saturnalia, for anyone who doesn't know, it's an ancient Roman festival that was held in midwinter around the time of Christmas. And the reference to it being held on the ice is to the famous Thames Frost Fairs. So between 1309 and 1814, the Thames froze over at least 23 times.
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah. The Thames was a different river back then. So to begin with, it was wider. It was shallower. So the flow of water was quite a bit slower than it is today. And also, there were quite a number of piers protruding out from some of the bridges, and that also slowed the flow of the river. So it was more inclined to freeze. I don't think it would happen nowadays, but it did. And on five of those occasions, the ice was thick enough to hold a frost fair. So the Courier goes on to describe the fair of 1814. But generally, these are the sort of things you could expect with others too. So booths were erected on the ice, and in one place, a large fire was kindled in an open pan at which a sheep was roasted whole, the meat being sold at a shilling per slice as Lapland mutton. A great wall or walk extending from Blackfriars Bridge to London Bridge and termed the City Road was formed, and for several days this road was crowded. 8 or 9 printing presses were erected, swings, bookstalls and skittles and all sorts of amusements were common, and the fair continued until the 6th of February when the thaw set in. So I don't know about you, but I find the idea of strolling down the middle of the Thames with hundreds of people along something called a city road. Not all that appealing, really. I don't know. It sounds a bit foolhardy to me. I think if I was attending a Thames Frost Fair, I'd be definitely hanging out at the booths near the bank side. I'm keeping an eye out for cracks in the ice so I can make a quick getaway.
I would be very far away from all the printing presses and open fires.
Yeah.
Health and safety nightmare, I think, is what you would probably call that nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe COVID's made us risk averse or something. I don't know. Or maybe they were just a little bit braver than us back then. But
life expectancy was shorter. I guess if you knew you're probably going to die by age 40, you'd want to go out with a bang, and maybe falling into the Thames during a fair would, you know, maybe be slightly more of an interesting way to go than just tuberculosis or, you know, childbirth. So I don't know.
They had pubs on there as well. One was called the City of Moscow.
Okay.
So you could imagine stumbling out of the City of Moscow and falling down a crack in the ice. And maybe that's not such a bad way to go.
No, you'd get in the paper at least.
Yeah. Yeah. They also had stalls that were sold keepsakes for that particular year. Things like spoons and printed cards. Yes. I was at Fridge Magnets.
Coasters and baseball caps,
yeah, and of course there was a lot of skating going on, as there would be.
Yes.
However, in terms of our big four severe winters, 1814 doesn't really compare to the two of the biggest, baddest European winters on record. The Great Winter of 1708-09, or Le Grand Hiver, as it was known in France, and the Great Frost of 1683-84. So the Great Winter of 1708-09, on the night of the 5th of January 1709, William Durham of Upminster near London recorded a low of minus 12 degrees C, that's 10 degrees Fahrenheit, the lowest he had ever measured since he started taking readings in 1697. Obviously, eyewitness accounts and local newspaper reports aren't that easy to come by for then. Our newspaper collections in the library certainly don't extend back that far. I did find some anecdotes of occurrences. So chicken combs froze solid and fell off. Soil froze to a depth of 1 meter. Trees exploded. Sailors aboard English naval vessels out in the North Sea died. Small birds perished in their millions. This is an interesting one. People went to bed and woke up in the morning with their nightcaps frozen to the bedhead.
Yeah, that sounds very false teethy, definitely.
It does, yeah. I'm amazed that anecdote has survived through history, to be honest, through generations.
But think of how much we've just laughed thinking about it. That's exactly how it survived.
Yeah, you'll never guess what happened.
Exactly.
And also bread froze and had to be cut with an axe. So that's another quite drastic thing to have to do. So without really having many newspaper articles, what you really need at this time is a really good diarist. So stand aside Samuel Pepys and Ann Lister and enter Ralph Thoresby. He's an antiquarian, Royal Society Fellow, merchant, nonconformist, and credited with being the first historian of the city of Leeds. So he was born in Leeds in 1658 and he died in 1725. So he was alive and experiencing our two severe winters, which you might think was a bit unlucky for him. But historically speaking, we were going through what was known as the Little Ice Age, and that was between the 16th and 19th centuries. Some have pinpointed it at between 1300 and 1850. So you could do a whole podcast on the Little Ice Age, no doubt. So just for our purposes, all we need to know really is that because of this, exceptionally cold winters were much more the norm whilst Ralph Thoresby was alive. He was educated at Leeds Grammar School, and at the age of 18, he was sent to the House for Relation in London as part of his grooming. And he maintained a diary from this point throughout the rest of his life. I think he was encouraged by his father to do so. An edited version of his diary was published in two volumes in 1830. And we do have a copy of volume one in local studies if anyone fancies a read. But this only takes us to 1707. Most of volume two can be viewed on the Thoresby Society website. That's www.thoresby.org. But even that published diary has some entries that are missing. So on digging a bit deeper, I found that there's a book called Ralph Thoresby, the Topographer, His Town and Times, by someone called Daniel Hopkin Atkinson, published in 1885. So back to 1709, from March 1679, Thoresby lived in Leeds, which is handy for us. And judging by his diary, and I've had the pleasure of perusing this diary, most of his time seems to consist of getting up incredibly early. We're talking 4 o'clock in the morning most days, writing, taking ladies to dances, visiting with associates, and also riding on horseback literally all over the country. He spends a lot of time traveling. So in February 1709, during our severe winter, he was down in London and preparing to make the journey back up to Leeds. And on the 14th, having set off, it's clear from his diary that the weather is just not good at all. And it gets steadily worse as he progresses north. By the 18th, he's in Doncaster. And this is what he says of that day's journey when he eventually arrives home in Leeds. He goes, "Begun our journey with courage, but was presently cooled, the road being full of snow, and which was worse upon a continued ice, the melted snow being frozen again, that made it dangerous and very troublesome. So that I was more fatigued with this last 20 miles than all the journey besides. My horse slipped dangerously often and once fell quite down as I was leading him into Wentbrig. But blessed be God, we arrived safe at our desired habitations betwixt 2 and 3 and found our families well. Blessed be his holy name. I was truly thankful and desirous to make public acknowledgement of the goodness of our merciful God in his house of prayer, whither I went with a joyful heart at 4. So,
I hope he took a different horse there.
He's so relieved to get back in one piece that he arrives home between 2 and 3, and he barely stays long enough to hug and kiss his relatives before he's off to church to give thanks for what he describes as protection from the many dangers my sins have exposed me to in about 300 miles of journey, and that in such a storm as the like has rarely happened. In actual fact, he says that, but we know that he has experienced this kind of thing before, because he was around for the 1683-84 Great Frost as well.
Really something, though. I mean, we don't, again, this is yet another point about how we have it easy nowadays, but that's an incredible journey to make on horseback with no protection against the elements except your coat and a hat, probably.
It's quite a journey in the middle of summer, really. I mean, obviously it was the only thing really that they had back then, but this guy traveled all over the place, and he must have just galloped around, you know.
but that also makes it more interesting, because he's used to traveling by horseback. He's been in all the elements, and you know, to point to this and say this is the worst, you know, he's not a soft, you know, he doesn't dally in horsebacking. he's a regular traveler, so it must truly have been something for him to speak in such a marveling tone about it.
Yeah,
you know it must have been bad.
Yeah. So if we go on now to the great frost of 1683-84, in December 1683, it began with a hard frost and an east wind and snow. On the 16th of January 1684, John Downes, a physician at Christ Hospital, London, noted of his thermometer, rather dramatically, I think, the spirit fell within the ball. It was about minus 4 degrees indoors, though, and minus 12 outside. So that's pretty cold. The Great Frost of 1684 is widely thought of as the worst in UK history. And of course, there was a frost fair on the Thames at the time. But what was happening up north in West Yorkshire and nearer to us? Well, luckily, we do have quite a nice account in Daniel Hopkin Atkinson's book, Ralph Thoresby, the Topographer, His Town and His Times. And he says, the year 1684 was that which opened with so intensely severe a season that the frozen Thames became a highway and a fairground throughout the greater part of January. The frost was general. And at Leeds, there were booths erected and sports held upon the River Aire, also covered with thick ice. So in a sense, it was like a mini Thames frost fair on the River Aire. The ice and the frost was throughout the whole of the country. He follows this with a diary entry from Ralph Thoresby from the 4th of January. And this is missing from Thoresby's published diary, so it's quite nice to actually find it. And it's an account of him walking up the River Aire. So he says, Thoresby, abroad with Mr. TB, walked with him and others from the mills below the old church, all up the main river, under the bridge to about the upper dam. The light continued frost not having been known or scarce heard of in these parts. So he sounds quite chipper there, doesn't he?
You can tell he hasn't been on a horse for 300 miles in that account, yes.
But Mr. Atkinson, he knows better, and we get a little quip from him, which he no doubt feels illustrates how bleak it was. And he says, this memorable winter put a check to Thoresby's early rising. Oh. So, yeah.
What did he get up at 5 a.m. instead of 4?
Yeah. And Atkinson follows this with a rather embittered diary entry from Thoresby, dated the 10th of March, 1684. So this is, again, is when we're starting to get the thawing of the ice. And Thoresby says, the vernal equinox being now returned, got up before 5. Resolving to do that now, which the violent and tedious storm, such as no history can parallel, hindered me most of the winter.
He basically hibernated is what happened.
Yeah. I wonder if people ever like ended up leaving their false teeth near the fire overnight.
Well, false teeth back then were, you know, made of wood and cadaver bones, so you wouldn't have left them soaking overnight, so it probably wasn't quite the same thing, but yeah.
I guess not.
A cheerful image for you, I'm very sorry.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, produced by Sarah Rose and Jill Carpenter. Join us next time when we will be exploring the life of Anne Walker.